Paul Denyer's confession was very different to the kinds of confessions police usually see. Normally, an offender will minimise his involvement or try to make excuses to mitigate his responsibility. But Denyer did none of these. He calmly admitted to killing three women and attempting to kidnap another. Rarely during the interview did he show emotion, and that was only when he was describing time during the attacks when the women didn't bend to his will. For all of his candour during the confession, we don't know the true extent of Denyer's crimes. While the general wisdom is that he was happy to confess to everything, that's not quite true. Denyer is selective in what he told police, and we must never forget his calm denials from the moment the police knocked on his door at 5:15 on the Saturday afternoon till his confession at 3:45 the following morning. He showed himself more than capable of lying without even breaking a sweat.
Once Denyer began the confession, something came over him that's really obvious when you look at the confession tape. He shows a little emotion, yet there's almost a pride in his account. It's quite horrifying to watch. I remember when I first looked at the confession tapes back when I was writing the book, I would think, if you turned the sound down and watched it, he could be talking about a sports game or fixing his car, not killing young women. Back then and now, I didn't have the luxury of turning the sound down. Like the detectives that night, I had to listen to it all. There was a righteousness about him and a sense of entitlement. The only time he shows any emotion was when the women went against their word or lied to him. After a pause lasting 6 seconds, Denyer's first words of the confession were the ones that told the detectives definitively that Elizabeth Stevens had caught the bus on the night she was murdered.
He spoke to Detective O'Loughlin here, and you told Detective O'Loughlin that you were responsible for the murders of the three women. Is that correct? Just tell us in your own words, Paul, what happened in relation to the death of Elizabeth Stevens at Lang Warren.
Saw her get off the bus.
He continued, I was walking across the road, just something hit me straight in the head, you know, go. So I ran across the road in front of all these cars and got to the other side where I followed her around the corner. I walked up behind her and stuck my left hand around her head, right here. He indicated with his hands how he had grabbed Elizabeth Stevens, and then I dragged her onto the front lawn and told her to shut up, and she just agreed to my terms. And I said, well, we're going to take a walk. So we walked down on the road. A couple of cars drove past us and I held her hand to make it look like, you know, a couple, I suppose, so it wouldn't arouse any suspicion. Walked past two people on the footpath, a guy and a girl, and they just didn't take any notice. Wilson asked if Elizabeth had screamed or cried out. Denyer said, no, I told her I'd kill her if she did. Denyer then grinned and added, with my fake gun. He described the fake gun as a piece of square aluminium piping with a wooden handle and a glove finger taped to the end. Inside the glove finger, ball bearings could be wedged in order to fire it.
I told her to shut up or so blow her head off.
Yeah.
Told her to kiss him again.
Did she do that?
No.
Did you feel any sexual urge towards her? At any stage?
I did when I saw her walking, but when I grabbed her, it cut off.
Cut off, come on.
Yes. grabbed her neck and pushed it up like that.
Daniel lit a cigarette as Darren O'Loughlin left the interview room to get a Melways Street directory so Paul could show them the route he'd taken from the bus stop to Lloyd Park with his captive. Daniel showed the detectives where he had walked with Elizabeth Stevens, and then he began describing her murder. It is in this description that the evasiveness begins to surface. His account is disjointed enough to make you wonder what he's leaving out. He said, "Walked in a bit of bushland beside the main track in Lloyd Park. Sat there, you know, stood in the bushes for a while, just, I can't remember, just standing there, I suppose. Held the gun to the back of her neck, walked across the track over the other small sand hill or something. And on the other side of that hill, she asked me if she could, you know, go to the toilet, so to speak. So I respected her privacy. So I turned around and everything while she did it and everything. When she finished, we just walked back toward where the goalposts are and we turned right and headed toward the area where she was found. Got to that area there and I started choking her with my hands and she passed out after a while. You know, the oxygen got cut off to her head and she just stopped and then I pulled out my knife and I stabbed her many times in the throat. And she was still alive, and then she stood up, and then we walked around and all that, just walked a few steps, and then I threw her on the ground and stuck my foot over her neck." Rod Wilson asked Denya why he'd stood on her neck. Denya said, "Ah, to finish her off." Denya said that Elizabeth Stevens' body had begun shaking, and then he began shaking to show them what her death throes had looked like. He described dragging her body to the creek bed where she was found. Wilson asked Denya if he'd ever met Elizabeth Stevens before he killed her. He said he hadn't. The detective knew that the injuries to Elizabeth were more extensive than Denya had admitted to. He hadn't mentioned the strange crisscross pattern on her chest. Wilson asked if he'd done that. Denya said that he didn't remember. You can tell by Wilson's expression that he's a little surprised Denya doesn't admit to the markings when he's been more than graphic in everything else.
"Can you tell me why you attacked her on that night?"
Just had the feeling, that's all.
What sort of feeling? Can you possibly describe it, where you had this feeling?
Just wanted to kill.
Denny continued. He said, "Just wanted to take a life because I felt my life had been taken." Wilson asked, "Why was that? By whom?" "David," Denya murmured. "Who's David?" "My elder brother." "When did he... Do you wish to say what he..." Wilson's tone suggests he knows what's coming.
"No, no."
"Was it of a sexual nature?"
"Yeah."
"When you were younger?" "Abused you?"
"Mm-hmm."
"And you felt cheated by that or something?"
"Yeah."
It was clearly an uncomfortable subject for Denya and Wilson didn't push him on it. He returned to questions about Elizabeth. He asked, "And did Elizabeth Stevens offer any resistance to you at any stage?"
"A little bit, when we got to the park."
"Was she frightened, do you think?"
"She didn't cry,"
Denya said, as if he admired her bravery. "Well, did she see you take the knife out of your pocket?"
"Nah, she would have blanked out or something."
He said he choked her before he took out the knife. Wilson asked where the knife was and Denya said he'd dumped it at the side of the road in Langwarrin. The blade had broken off and he had dumped the pieces together. Denya said,
"Well, it bent when I was stabbing her. The blade just went zoop and I broke the rest of it off and then carried it in my pocket till I got to where I dumped them."
"Were you angry?"
"Happy, sad, angry. many things.
Means it's sort of emotions at the time.
Wilson asked why he moved the body from the site of the murder, and Denya told him that it was in order to destroy evidence. He thought the rain would wash away footprints and blood, and that investigators would have difficulty finding the exact location of the murder. Denya described ripping a branch from a tree near the creek to conceal the body. In the next part of the interview, there were the first of several indignant responses from Denya. She said she was 17 when she was 18, he said, as if Elizabeth had owed him the truth. It spoke of his lack of any kind of understanding that this might have been a girl trying to sound younger than she was to a man bent on doing her harm. You can see how disjointed the account gets in this next part. Denya described strangling Elizabeth Stevens and showed the detectives how he pushed his thumb into her throat and made a stabbing motion as he described stabbing and slashing her throat. He told them that Elizabeth had then got to her feet. Are you saying that she got up after that? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did in a way. She got up and walked. And she didn't cry. She was just normal.
So how far, when you say she walked, how far did she actually walk?
Around in circles with me.
What, you were still holding her?
Yeah, just under one arm.
Why were you doing that? Did you help her up? Is this what you're indicating?
Yeah.
So what happened after she walked around in circles?
There was a puddle of, like, flooded area there, and I pushed her into it so she could wash her, you know, blood off her and all that. And then I dragged her across the water.
Well, when did you put your foot on her neck, as you described before?
When she was lying on the side of that sort of flooded area with her legs in the water.
And why did you do that?
To kill her,
Denya said matter-of-factly. So you did that and then she went into a sort of spasm, you said before, or some sort of quivering.
Yeah, her whole body just shook and everything, and then she stopped.
Did you think she was dead?
No, she was still breathing from her neck.
How did you know that?
I could hear it.
How long did it last for?
5 minutes.
Did you ever strike her in any way? Punch her or leg? Maya?
It turned out that Elizabeth had caught an earlier bus home. Denya told Wilson that he'd first seen her around 7:15, and the entire attack and hiding her body had taken about half an hour. He described walking back to Sharon's mother's house, and Sharon's mother had asked where he'd been. He told her that he'd been to visit his mother, but she hadn't been home. He explained to Wilson that he didn't have any blood on him. The rain had washed the blood from his hands, but he was drenched from being out for hours in the rain. Denya had told the detectives that he'd eaten dinner, soup and a roast, and waited for Sharon to come home from work. For Charlie Bezina and the other detectives watching on the monitor, as Denya told them things that only the offender would know, they mentally ticked them off the list.
When we look at Denya, when you start saying, okay, like you said, oh, well, she was on the bus, right, because he's told us that, and only the offender knows that. Okay, we know how he abducted Debbie. I mean, then now how and why the wire was cut for Natalie Russell and things like that on Nat's track. You start saying, right.
Rod Wilson moved the interview questions onto Debbie Frame's murder. Denya hopped into her car when he saw her get out and go into the milk bar. Once she started up the car and was in the middle of a U-turn, he startled her and she drove straight into the wall of the milk bar. Denya said,
I told her to, you know, shut up or I'll blow her head off and all that shit.
Wilson asked Denya if he'd noticed anything in the car when he hopped in. Denya told him that he'd seen the baby capsule in the back seat. Even if Debbie Frame hadn't told him, he would have known that he was killing the mother of a young baby.
Denya told her where to drive. He said, I told her when we got there that if she gave any signals to anyone, I'd blow her head off. I'd decorate the car with her brains.
Denya was sitting upright directly behind the young mother as he directed her toward Taylor's Road. Wilson asked if Denya knew this area well.
Yeah, I know it very well, he replied. I used to sit there in the car at night a couple of years ago and smoke marijuana.
Denya had directed Debbie Freem to stop the car near some trees on Taylor's Road. He said she'd told him to take her money in her car and that he told her he didn't want either. He then told her to get out of the car. Denya had tucked his fake gun down the front of his tracksuit pants and pulled a cord from his pocket.
I popped it over her eyes really quickly so she didn't see it because I was going to strangle her, but I didn't want her to see the cord first. I lifted the cord up and I said, can you see this? And she just put her hand up to grab it and feel it. And when she did that, I just yanked on it really quickly around her neck. And then I was struggling with her for about 5 minutes.
She was struggling, asked Wilson.
Yeah, until she started to faint a bit. And then when she was, you know, like weaker, I pulled my knife out of my sock and I just started stabbing her around the neck and chest several times.
You strangled her? Asked O'Loughlin. Is this the first thing that happened?
Yeah, she sort of weakened and fell to the ground and that's when I stabbed her in the throat.
Once?
Many times, and once in the stomach.
Where was she? Asked O'Loughlin.
Lying on the ground.
Was she dead or alive when you stabbed her in the throat?
Almost dead.
So you stabbed her a number of times, and then what happened? Asked Wilson.
She started breathing out of her neck, just like Elizabeth Stevens. I could just hear bubbling noises.
Did Debbie put up any resistance?
Yeah, she put up quite a fight, and her white jumper was pulled off during that time as well. I just felt the same way I did when I killed Elizabeth Stevens.
What happened after you stabbed her around the throat and chest area?
I lifted up her top and then ploughed the knife into her gut.
The detectives knew that the top had a hole in it, corresponding with the stab wound. Denya hadn't lifted the top until she was dead. Wilson asked Denya why, and he replied he wasn't sure. You lifted her top to do that? Asked O'Loughlin.
Yeah, Denya confirmed.
Do you know why you lifted her top?
I wanted to see how big her boobs were, said Denya.
Beg your pardon? Asked O'Loughlin, momentarily taken aback by the childish statement.
I wanted to see how big her boobs were, he repeated.
Was that part of the fantasy? Pressed O'Loughlin, trying to keep a hint of disgust from creeping into his voice.
I don't know.
You actually recall thinking that way?
Sort of, Denya replied. And I saw her bare stomach, so I just lunged at it with the knife.
Just like the markings on Elizabeth Stevens, Denya couldn't or wouldn't explain the small pinpoint stab injuries Debbie had suffered to her back.
I dragged her about a metre into the trees and where she was lying against the fence. And I broke off two branches off the nearest tree and threw them over the body. And I hopped back in the car again. I adjusted the seat to match my height because she was a lot smaller than me. And headed back Madden Street. Why to Madden Street? Wasn't too close, wasn't too far from home.
This is another point of evasiveness. Denya had left the car outside the Christian centre he attended and, ironically, Darren O'Loughlin attended the same church. Since Denya had begun his confession by asking Darren if he was a Christian, we have to wonder if he's skirting around something much bigger here. Describing parking Debbie's car, Denya said,
I pulled up outside the New Life Christian Centre. I grabbed my jumper and wiped off my prints off the steering wheel, wiped my prints off the transmission lever or gear stick, off the handbrake, off the doorknobs on the inside. I got out of the car and just walked home.
Once he was home, he took off all his bloodstained clothes and washed them.
He was home in time to call his girlfriend Sharon at work and arrange to meet her at Cannanook Railway Station. Daniel described returning to the car the following morning to take Debbie's purse and pocket the $22 she had in it.
I wanted to see what her name was and everything out of her wallet, so...
Right.
I took it up to the golf course and buried it.
So you'd be able to show us where that is?
Exactly.
Okay, would you be able to find the spot?
All right, I'll find it.
Wilson asked him, did at any stage Debbie Freem mention anything about her personal life to you? No. Why did you kill her?
Same reason I killed Elizabeth Stevens. I just wanted to.
It is inconceivable that Debbie wouldn't have told Denya about her baby, that she wouldn't have begged him not to hurt her for the sake of the baby. Her defence wounds alone suggested how fiercely she fought for her life. Her brother Troy talks about his sister's fighting spirit.
She's a pretty strong woman. Like, I know she must have put up a real fight against Daniel because she was tough as nails. Even being half his size, I know she would have fought like a crazy cat. And even after having a baby, she would have fought even harder. Like, he must have been scared to hell. He picked the wrong girl to pick on.
Then it was time to talk about Natalie. The Sunday morning sun had yet to rise, but birds were beginning to waken and sing, while inside the Frankston police station, a young man began telling two tired detectives how he cut the throat of a schoolgirl. Ironically, this was the same time the Sunday newspapers would have been arriving on doorsteps around Melbourne. Headlines in both the Sunday Herald Sun and the Sunday Age screamed, "Killer strikes again," and both papers ran with stories about how police were frantically hunting for the killer of Natalie Russell, convinced he would strike again. The papers would have to wait until Monday to run their Man 21 in Court headlines, much to the relief of everyone in Melbourne, especially those living in Frankston and its surrounding suburbs. Rod Wilson began the home stretch, almost forgetting that Saturday had turned into Sunday. He said, "The next incident occurred yesterday. Sorry, it's now the day after, but on Friday. What can you tell me about that?" Denya again told Wilson about his car overheating and having to first stop at the reserve and then on Sky Road opposite the entrance to the bike track. He had been up there earlier that day and cut the holes in the fences, then returned to Sky Road to wait for a victim. Denya said, "I sat in the car for 20 minutes till about 3:15 and then I saw a girl coming down the road." The girl had been wearing a blue school uniform and he'd seen her coming out of the road where John Paul College was. "When I saw her coming over the hill, I predicted straight away where she'd be heading because she crossed the road. She crossed the road onto the golf course side. I knew exactly where she'd be heading." Armed with a red-handled knife, Denya entered the track ahead of Natalie Russell and climbed through one of the holes he'd cut to wait for her. Wilson asked him if he had any other weapons. Denya replied, "Oh, and the leather strap." "What was that? What sort of leather strap?" "Just a thin, you would have found it at the scene, in two pieces." "What was that used for?" asked Wilson. "Strangling." Denya described climbing out of the hole in the fence as Natalie walked past. He said, "She turned around once and saw me, and I stuck about 10 metres behind her until I got to the second hole. And just when I got to that hole, I walked up behind her and stuck my left hand around her mouth and held the knife to her throat. And that's when that cut happened." Denya indicated the cut on his thumb. "I cut that with my own blade," he admitted.
And here's the most chilling bit of the entire interview. Danya said, I told her I was going to cut her throat. I said I was going to, cut her throat. And I walked through the hole in the fence. I followed her through and I dragged her into the trees. Like she offered, she said, oh, you can have sex with me if you want. She goes, you can have all my money, have sex with me. And things, just said disgusting things like that, really. Danya shook his head. It was the only time during the many hours of interviewing that he'd showed any emotion. His anger and disgust at Natalie Russell were obvious. What was equally obvious to the detectives was that Danya had no comprehension of the fact that Natalie had been a young woman begging for her life. She must have realised she was in the hands of the serial killer and had obviously been willing to do anything to save her life. Danya completely failed to see that. And did that upset you? Wilson asked, surprised by his sudden outburst. In a way, replied the killer, his anger quickly subsiding and his voice becoming even once again. And the next bit is equally callous and distressing, but it is so important that we see what Danya is capable of. And I got her to kneel down in front of me and I held the knife blade over her eye really closely. And she had the same colour eyes as I have. Why did you hold the knife so close to her eye for? Just so she could see the blade? And why was she kneeling? No, she was lying on the ground at that stage and I was lying on top of her. I wasn't lying, I was kneeling on top of her, just holding her by the throat with the knife next to her eye. And she struggled and then the knife cut her face and she was bleeding a bit then. And that's when she got up and she started to scream a bit and I just said, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. And if you don't shut up, I'll kill you. And if you don't do this, I'll kill you. And if you don't do that. And she said, what do you want from me? And I said, all I want from you is to shut up. And so she was kneeling on the ground and I put the strap around her neck to strangle her and it broke in half. And then she started violently struggling for about a minute until I got her onto her back again and pushed her head back like this and cut her throat. Danya mimicked Natalie Russell's last movements as he described his attack on her. But his description of what he did to the dying schoolgirl made the detective's stomachs turn. I cut a small cut at first and then she was bleeding and I stuck my fingers into her throat and grabbed her cords and I twisted them. Wilson kept his voice even. Why'd you do that? My whole fingers, like that, much of my hand was inside her throat. Danya indicated by holding up his hand for the benefit of the detectives. Do you know why you did that? Repeated Wilson. Stop her from breathing. And then she slowly stopped. She sort of started to faint. And then she was weak, a bit weaker. I grabbed the opportunity of throwing her head back and one big large cut, which sort of almost cut her head off, and then she slowly died. Why did you want to kill her? Asked Wilson, rubbing his forehead. Just the same reason as before, just everything came back through my mind again. I kicked her before I left. Why is that? While she was dead, just booted her. Why did you kick her after? Like, she was obviously dead at that stage. Make sure she was dead. Kicking her, would that make sure she was dead? Well, if she had moved, I would have known. Danya described walking down the bike track with his bloodied hands in his pockets. Coming out from the track onto Sky Road, he saw something that made him stop. Two uniformed police officers were walking around his car, taking down its details. Danya told Wilson that he had merely ducked his head, turned right, and walked down Sky Road towards his home and away from the cops. There is so much about the interview that's disturbing. One moment in particular has stayed with Charlie Bazina.
When the realisation during the interview comes where he's got a bit of a smug look about him and Or he looks at his shoe again, and Rod says, well, what are you looking at? And he said, oh, I'm just looking at the sign. Well, what do you mean? Denya wants to show Rod how smart he is. Didn't they have to pick up the shoe? He could have said nothing. He picks up the shoe and he's looking at it, and they're wanting a response from an interviewer. What are you looking at? Which he got. He just wanted to show, look how smart I am. Well, after I killed Elizabeth, I melted my shoe so it wouldn't be any shoe impressions. See how smart I am?
What are you looking for?
I was just looking at the treasure.
Was
it? I melted a band so you wouldn't be able to trace my shoes.
Denya had either an intelligence or a rat cunning around committing crimes.
He thought out his crimes when he said he'd come back and he melted the soles of his shoes after killing Elizabeth. And this type of thing. His recall, he took us straight back to where one of the purses was buried, straight to that location. Smart enough to put himself in every location, every crime scene, because he said he was a big boy. If the police thought, well, I told you I was there. You know, well, I got no issues. Had an answer. How'd you get the injuries to your hands? Oh, working on my car, the fan belt. But he then knew when that question was put by Rod, when he says, we're going to get a forensic doctor to talk to you and examine you. And we asked him about his finger, and he would then, the penny then dropped. That's when the break goes to the toilet, speaks to the detective and says, I did the three of them. Because he then knew that he did injure his finger in killing Natalie, and he either took the punt. He may have preempted it, and we may have not had that little piece of skin. And he didn't know that, but he then jumped, which was good, because let's say we didn't have that, we had nothing else. Because hadn't it been for that or his admissions, he would have walked out the door that night or that early morning after all of that if he stuck to it. But he had an answer. He could have just said no comment. It's like you see the movies. He's playing cat and mouse with the police.
Based on what he saw that night of Denya, did Charlie think that if he hadn't have been caught, he would be out killing again?
100%. 100%. That was the greatest relief of being able to say when we had that admission, well, we've stopped it. We've stopped it.
After the interview where Denya confessed to killing Elizabeth, Debbie and Natalie and grabbing Rosa Toth off the street with the intention of killing her, he was taken by the homicide detectives to all the locations.
And what people don't know, when he does a reenactment, he's doing the reenactment with Rod, but there's about eight of us also off camera. Because we were part of the investigation, we were following him around and all this stuff, because we lived it. That was our life for that period of time. And we wanted to hear it. We wanted to see it. We wanted that result.
It was a long day for police photographer Howard Hopper. From the post-mortem to the Frankston police station, to the reenactment and to Denya's unit, Howard got an up-close and personal insight as he filmed Denya taking the police through his crimes.
I formed an opinion that he was proud of what he did. Like, when we're doing the reenactments, we're down the walkway through the golf course and he was indicating the other side of the 10-foot-high cyclone fence is where the girl was killed and that's where the body was recovered from. And the council had been back and fixed it. And he said, through there. And one of the blokes said, oh, we'll have to cut a hole in the fence and started to muck around there. And Daniel went up and said, no. And he took the pliers from the detective and he cut high up on the fence. He cut a piece of wire. He followed it down to close to the ground and cut the wire again. Then he got hold of it with the pliers and pulled it out. Within 4 or 5 seconds, there's a great big hole. But he could just walk straight through the fence. I stood there in amazement. And I saw in his face that, yeah, I'm smarter than you sort of thing. He was proud of what he had done. Never once saw any remorse or anything like that. He was happy showing us what he had done.
Well, the car was sitting over there.
This is Debbie Freem's car we're talking about.
Yeah, Pulsar.
Right.
I was walking down this road here. Saw her jump out of the car.
Yes.
Ran into the milk bar here. So I jumped in the back seat of the car.
That's right.
And the car was directly across the road, so I could see her from inside the car in there.
what caused you to select her, is it, at that time?
Just that gay feeling.
Right. So what happened then?
And then she came out. While I was crouched down, I could hear her footsteps coming closer to the car.
Mm-hmm.
And she hopped in the car, but she didn't see me in the back. And she went to do a U-turn, pulled out the gun that I had, just as she was doing that turn. She kept going straight into this wall.
What did she hit?
Which caused a ding on the bike.
Right. And then you drive off down this kind of
cabin. Yeah.
Howard could also see the refinement in Denya's planning. He'd gone from snatching Elizabeth as she got off the bus, slipping into the back seat of Debbie's car, to the careful planning and cutting of the fence on the bike track.
It's like the hole in the fence. He explained that he got into behind the fence and someone walked past and he got it and he looked and he watched how far they went to basically to go out of sight or hearing, and he was watching for the next person come along. And when Natalie walked through the person that was in front of her was gone out of the lane. So he's grabbed her and dragged her back through the fence. So he's back out of view again. But there was a lot of planning in it, in that he set it up, it was an ambush, and he waited for a target to come and that there was clear opportunity not to be seen. But he then left the body there. There was no attempt to conceal it or anything like that. And this is where I get this feeling about his capacity to continue again. It's definitely there because the lack of remorse, the planning is isolated. It's not a neighbour or a family or someone that's annoyed him. It's just someone that's walking past.
What can you tell me about this?
I went up there earlier that day and cut the holes in the fences.
What did you use to cut the holes in the fences?
A pair of pliers. Stood here and watched Natalie Russell walk around the corner. And then I went through this hole and waited behind the trees there.
Right.
Until I saw her walk past here and heading that way.
Right.
And when she got about 10 metres down the track here, I came out of the fence.
As we're walking along here, are you still maintaining that distance behind her?
No, I was getting closer each time. I walked along the grass like this and make a sound.
So you wouldn't be heard?
Yeah.
When the police entourage went to Denya's house as part of the reenactment, Howard Hopper was there to catch it all on film. I asked him for his impressions of the unit, which Denya shared with his girlfriend Sharon.
You're talking about teenagers basically living in the house and that. When we were doing the reenactments, he showed us how he made the knife. It wasn't a purchased knife, that, but it was a piece of 1/8 inch by probably 1.5 inch or so aluminium. And he showed us where he actually rubbed it up and down on stones. There's a fence, if I remember rightly. And he actually sharpened it on that. So the knife itself was homemade. But he showed us how he actually made the knife. So the things like that in the house was when we started to get the picture and the story was part of his showing off.
From behind the camera, Howard studied the young man who had just confessed to killing three women.
No, I certainly didn't feel threatened in any way. He was friendly, if you could say that sort of word in that circumstance. But he was showing us and he was explaining things. And for a reenactment, you don't get that very often. It'd be interesting going into the actual mind, the thoughts of what were going on there, but it's not of a sane person or a normal person. The opinion I formed was that he was proud. He was showing us what he was capable of doing. I wouldn't give him a high IQ. He didn't strike me as an intellect or anything along, but he had a hell of an animal cunning. You could just see it there that he could manipulate his way in, and he was, with us, he was telling us his story.
Proudly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Another thing that Howard noted was the lack of remorse.
saw no remorse whatsoever, absolutely nothing. There was no feeling or anything to the victims. There was absolutely no reference to them at all. I'm talking about over basically a two-day period, that it was a Saturday and a Sunday. I haven't seen him since, but no, he was the centre of the attention, that's for sure, and he played up to it.
And while watching Denya reenact his crimes, Howard got the feeling that if he hadn't been caught, his crimes would have escalated.
That's the impression I had, that there was plans ahead for many, many more.
When the reenactment was over, Denya was taken to jail. His night in the spotlight was over. His confession and its announcement to the media happened too late to feature in the Sunday newspapers. But news soon trickled out.
Paul Charles Denya appeared before bail justice Kenneth Mackay at Frankston Police Station at 9 a.m. Remanded in custody to the Melbourne Magistrates Court tomorrow, he was transferred in a divisional van accompanied by a police car. Several bystanders and shoppers at a nearby market yelled abuse as the vehicles left the complex.
And then the families of Elizabeth, Debbie and Natalie were able to put a face to the killer. Elizabeth's cousin Rebecca saw how big Denya was.
I just remember thinking, he's a really big person, man. And I remember my mum saying that as well, and Liz never had a chance. But the other thing I remember thinking was that he looked normal. He just looked like a normal person. And like in my mind, it was, he was a monster. Why doesn't he look like a monster? I remember that was another question I don't know if I ever asked out loud, but in my head, he just looked normal.
And once something like this happens, life will never be the same again.
There was definitely an element of our innocence kind of being removed at that point. You're getting pulled into an adult world by default because it's happened within your family. So you don't get to not live it, right? It's not something anyone would want a 12-year-old or 13-year-old or any child to live through. So there's a lot of adult conversation that you're exposed to that you probably shouldn't be. And it's not at the fault of the adults, it's just the situation that we were in.
Some of those conversations were around revenge.
I don't remember being angry. I remember being sad that Liz had gone. I remember other members of my family being angry. I remember my uncle. I remember one conversation about the fact that if he ever got out of jail, he wouldn't be on this earth for very long. But I didn't feel the same way because I didn't have the maturity to understand that that's how people would feel, or, you know, the anger that people would have and that response to want revenge or hurt the person that's taken someone from you. That wasn't something I could comprehend at that time.
People all around Denya, who had pegged him as odd, all reacted in a similar way when he was arrested for the murders in Frankston. They weren't surprised. Davin, his old manager at Coringle Safeway, had seen him just days earlier.
When it all came out, I wasn't overly surprised. The day before the last girl was murdered, he actually came into the store. He hadn't come into the store for a while. Came in with his mum or somebody. And he's wearing a hat and dark sunglasses. And I remember looking at him thinking, well, that's a bit odd because I haven't seen him in there for a while and normally you wouldn't see him wearing a hat and sunglasses. And he just looked at me and smirked. And I thought, it's you. You're the one, it's fucking you. So that, like, completely freaked me out, like, at the time. But, yeah, I wasn't surprised. that he was just so smug about it.
Because even though Paul had left Safeway, it seemed he hadn't left the workers alone.
One of the guys that was working there as well, Paul was stalking his girlfriend for a while. And a week before the last murder, him and one of the other guys at work actually went and saw the police and said, it's him. This is what he's been doing.
In a coincidence found only in true stories, Jenny, the woman who had been chased home from Safeway by the trolley boy, found out her mum had befriended a woman on a computer course she was taking. The woman turned out to be Paul Denyer's mother. Jenny was never in any doubt that Denyer was the trolley boy who followed her home. But it wasn't until her mum heard the truth from Denyer's mother that her family finally believed the seriousness of what happened that night.
And the mother actually asked the son who committed the murders whether he recalled it, which he did. But perhaps it was the way my mother phrased it at the time, but I know it annoyed me somewhat because the sense of being believed, like, why would you need to ask him when I've already told you it happened? And I know it's him. Why would you need verification from the actual serial killer that it had happened? But he did agree, yes, it was.
Like others who were stalked by Paul Denyer, it wasn't until his picture was splashed across the front page of newspapers and in the top stories on the television news that Mary realised who he was. After being terrorised at her home by the same intruder she'd seen over and over hanging out at her dance school, Mary got a shock when the young man was revealed as the serial killer.
It wasn't until I saw him in the papers and stuff that I realised who this bloke was. I saw it in the paper and on TV, and then I looked at him and I thought, oh, my God, that's that guy that was at the dance, was at the pub.
A chance encounter with two police officers at the Seaford Bistro gave Mary the opportunity to tell of her encounters with the young man who she now knew was Paul Denyer.
After he'd been arrested at the Seaford Bistro where we used to go for a meal after the dance, two police turned up and then they came over to us and they said, do you mind if we interview you? And we said, no, we don't mind. I really can't remember exactly all the questions that they asked. One of them was, at least one of them was a woman. They were dressed in their police uniforms. Anyway, as they got up to go, the woman policeman turned to me and said, you should take a ticket in tats, as much as to say I was the luckiest person around at that time. Because when he was interviewed after he was arrested, he told them all the things he'd been doing, you know, and he was gloating about it apparently.
And thinking back to the encounter she had, Mary couldn't help but feel she could have been his next victim.
Maybe he followed me home from the hotel in his car one night and found out where I lived. Either that or he broke into the car. As I said, I found it open and there was some information in there. But I don't know. He seemed to be targeting me at that particular stage. I think I was next. He enjoyed watching them suffer, these poor women. What a terrible death they had. I consider myself the luckiest person on earth.
And Donna Vaines, who'd had a narrow escape when Denyer broke into her flat and killed her cats, how did she feel when Denyer was apprehended? According to her mum, Gloria, she was never the same.
She mentally went downhill, and all she kept going on about, oh, I'm so scared, what if he gets out, what if he gets out, meaning Paul Denyer.
While the police were tied up with arresting and interviewing Paul Denyer, for Natalie Russell's family, there was the tragedy of identifying her. For her mum, Carmel, it was more than that. She knew that the only way to know for sure it was Natalie, she would need to see her daughter.
Brian didn't want to go and see her. I wanted to go and see her to make sure it was her dad. And I went with some of the family, some of the girls, Lisa, I think Lisa and Janine, and a couple of her cousins came. I remember going in and that's Natalie, very puffy in the face, and of course they did a good job, whatever they had to do to her. She was pretty messed up. And I remember touching her and touching her hair, and Natalie, it is you. Because as you're walking along the street, you know, after it's happened, you click, oh, that's Natalie. And they go, no, it can't be Natalie. And I say to myself, no, now you know it's not her because you know that was her. I was always so glad that I saw her in that coffin because I would have probably thought, maybe it wasn't, or maybe. But because I saw her and I realised that is her, that did really help me.
For Natalie's friend Karen, the arrest marked the beginning of a quest to make sense of what had happened.
I remember asking my dad to buy all the papers and every single thing that was in print to just bring them home to me. So he had gone to like the local surveys and got me the papers and I'd seen his picture, but just thinking he just looked like such a thug and thinking he looked really unintelligent and how could this happen, really? How on earth could that happen? Just this absolute meathead. I remember thinking he was a meathead, really 90s term, but just how on earth, what was she doing down there? Because at that time, I don't think I'd realised that it was the time that it was that it had happened because she wasn't found until the evening and I was thinking he'd taken her down there in the evening and it wasn't that it was in the afternoon. But yeah, like how did he happen to be there? How did she happen to be there? How did that happen?
The capture of the Frankston serial killer was good news for everyone, but it's important to spare a thought for Danya's family. I will never forget his sister-in-law telling me how she found out. On the Sunday morning of Paul's arrest, Melissa Danya was woken early by the telephone. It was her father. "It's Paul," he said. "They've arrested Paul for the Frankston murders." All of Melissa's uneasy feelings about Paul over the last couple of months suddenly took on a terrible meaning. She put down the phone in shock, the words, "It's Paul," echoing through her mind. Steve Danya lay in a peaceful sleep that Sunday morning, and Melissa, tears in her eyes, painfully realised that what she had to tell her husband would ruin his life. It would taint all of his memories and it would take away the brother that he had loved and protected for over two decades. She shook him gently awake and told him that his brother was a murderer. Spending time with Steve and Melissa Danya taught me a lot. Love doesn't turn to hate in a second. How can someone you love turn out to be so bad? And the hardest question of all, could we have known? After Danya's arrest, a lot of women saw his picture in the news and realised they'd had a lucky escape. Even though Danya hadn't been questioned about the break-in at his neighbour Julia's house the previous year, the police must have looked back over their records and seen the damage wrought to those in his proximity and joined the dots. It was easy in this case because Julia had told the police that she thought he was responsible.
I had a phone call from the police to say, actually, it was your neighbour doing all of these things. And we, you know, think that, yes, he did break into your unit. And then they asked some questions around, you know, what sort of things happened and did I have any small animals? And I'm grateful to say that I didn't at the time because I understand Donna's animals came to a fairly awful end.
Many were left devastated in the wake of Danya's attacks, but Julia felt she was able to separate herself a bit from the hate directed toward her.
As we're sitting here, here's what's occurring to me. He actually carved a message into my furniture. He slashed my piano, which was precious to me, but he carved a message into a chest of drawers. It was, "Let Jesus have sex with you." And I think what that says to me, when I think back to the time, is that what occurred was a very spiritual thing. He was distressed. He knew I was a Christian. And perhaps that's the heart of the message there, that he was very unhappy. And maybe his loathing of women, maybe knowing what he knew of me, he felt that that would be the most poisonous thing. And so for me, now thinking about it, it felt like a very spiritual attack. And in many ways, then that removed me from the equation because it wasn't necessarily me he was cross with.
Part of the complex feelings Julia had in the aftermath of her encounter with Denya was that she survived to tell the tale.
I feel incredible sadness and grief for the people who've been hurt as a result of what Paul has chosen to do. What happened to the girls was just so very horrific and has ripple effects that continue generation upon generation. I'm very blessed that I have the ability to sit here with you and tell you my recollections of my neighbour who had coffee with me and ended up being a serial killer. I have no illusions that I am any different to any of the other people that he came into contact with in a malicious way. I am just grateful to not have met a similar end, which could so easily have happened. My experience of that teaches me that there are incredibly unsafe people in the world today, and that I may not recognise them, and that we shouldn't kick ourselves if we don't recognise the Paul Denyers, because they are operating on a plane where they are deliberately flying under the radar in order to do what they are doing and choosing to do.
Victoria has had few serial killers in its history, and with each thankfully rare occurrence, we need to learn everything we can to recognise the signs. The reality was that in the case of the Frankston murders, several women had reported Denya to the police. Julia had told them she thought the break-in at her flat, where her pictures, clothes and bedding had been slashed, was her neighbour Paul. But nothing was done.
The police did ring and say, "Hey, it actually was your neighbour. And yes, you were right, it was him breaking in."
Julia said her grandmother rang the police during Denya's killing spree and told them she was sure it was him.
She rang the police and said, "I'm absolutely sure it's my granddaughter's old neighbour." And I don't know why. She loved a theory, my grandmother, and she was always watching people. Quite the hermit, but quite savvy with humans. And she was just sure that it was him. And I think they just kind of put her suggestion aside, but I know that she did ring the Crime Stoppers number at the time and say, "I think it's that guy killing people."
And Gloria Vaines had said that Tricia had told the police her suspicions about Denya too.
The police did get told, but I think it may have been her dad. I'm not sure. It was either her or her dad. Because the message I got back after that was the police said, "Oh, you can't just go knocking on people's door and accusing them or wanting to search."
6 weeks before Natalie was murdered on the way home from school, she wrote two letters to the editor as part of an English task.
I know one of the essays she did was for capital punishment, but she also wrote one against. The papers only published the for one.
I don't have a copy of the one she wrote against capital punishment. Years ago when I wrote the book, her family gave me a copy of the one for capital punishment. It's dated June 16th. So Natalie may have been aware of the killing of Elizabeth Stevens. Natalie's writing is haunting.
In the current situation of serious crimes on the increase, I think the option of capital punishment should be strongly considered. Crimes such as abductions, rapes and murder are becoming everyday occurrences, and offenders should be made to pay appropriately. If offenders are put in prison, they will eventually serve their sentence, while the family will continue to suffer for the rest of their lives. She goes on to say, if an innocent life is either taken or ruined, then those responsible should be made to suffer the same fate as they have imposed on their victims and families. This is particularly haunting because when she wrote it, Natalie only had 6 weeks left to live. On the next episode of the Frankston Murders...
This was really apex killing, predatory apex killing.
And he just point blank looked at me and said, no, I didn't do it.
He will come back and kill again if he's ever released. And then you've got people like us going through a lifetime of torment.